Hey, welcome to
Blog Talk Radio.
That time again, ladies and gentlemen. That time again on a Wednesday evening at the 8 o'clock hour. It is the Blog Talk Radio Network, the K Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio. My name is Eric Payne, the Citizen Payne, also known as the Sun, and you are?
Yes, I'm your mother. K Thompson here, everyone. Welcome to K Thompson Live. We have a dynamite show on. And we're going to be talking to some exciting people. And, of course, our co-hosts are all exciting. And that's going to be Byron Zahn is calling in later. Get Wayne Gilman, of course, the former news director at WLRD DLS, where I spent a lot of time. And Eric Payne here, my son. And then Dr. Leonard Jeffries is going to be on tonight. Okay, and he's going to be giving an update on where we are up to date. Where we are, as you know, the black community. And he's also going to be talking about, I think, FireCon is coming on a Sunday. And I don't know if it's going to be here in New Jersey or someplace in the city, but we will find out. So let's go to one of our guys who may be on the air now.
Yeah, let's welcome in Wayne Gilman. Okay, Wayne is calling from Byron Saunders, our co-host, one of our resident guests. Byron, how you doing today?
Well, I'm blessed and highly favored, and I want to just say happy birthday to the esteemed and one and only black madam herself of radio, Kay Thompson. Happy belated birthday, Kay.
Thank you, Byron. Thank you very much. You can give me all the adjectives that you want.
And it's nice to be back. I was on assignment last week, as you know, and but it's always I kind of miss being on my spot here because I love the conversation and the opportunity to talk to people about our history and about all the things going on. So it's good to be back.
Well, why don't you give a little brief on what I didn't get a chance to get into it as extensively as I might have liked. Can you give a brief description about what it was you were attending last week? What was the function?
Surely. Hunter College has opened up a brand new gallery where they have just opened up an exhibit featuring future farmers, an exhibition of selected projects from 23 years of work. And this is located right at the corner of 119th and 3rd Avenue. So it's right up in the Harlem, a brand new facility that Hunter College just opened. And this exhibit is engaging a conversation about the ecology, green technology, our reflections and connections to Mother Earth, and how artists have used Mother Earth to showcase stories. Of 23 years of stories, and they hired actors to be the exhibit messengers. And so this is an exhibit that runs through the second week of February of 2018. It's free to the public, and museum hours are every Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday from 12 to 5 p.m. So come on out. I'm there on schedule for this week, Friday, and I will give you a personal tour free of charge.
Now, where is that again?
It's at 119th. It's at 119th and 3rd Avenue, right on the corner. You can't miss it. The actual address is 2180 3rd Avenue and 119th Street, Harlem, 10035.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And for more details, of course, 212-396-7819. But it's a really good exhibit for all ages, and you can touch these items. This is not one of those come and don't touch type of museum exhibits. They actually encourage you to touch some of the items and artifacts on display.
Oh, really?
All right.
Yeah.
They tell
a story. It's an amazing story, guys. I was really impressed with the artistry first and foremost, but the fact that they were using pieces of earth and pieces out of a building from Baltimore, floorboards to show you how it is all connected. Everything in life is connected to Mother Earth. It's amazing.
Right. Right. Let's bring in also another co-host. I believe this is Wayne Gill. I'm not sure. Is this 718 Wayne Gill?
Yeah, this is me. I don't know if you can hear me now.
You're calling from a little bit of different number today, huh?
Yeah. Let me tell you what happened to me today. I'm anxious to see that exhibit. I believe that might have been Spanish Harlem that Byron was talking about, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
It's on the edge of it.
That's correct.
119th and 3rd. But I just came in from Harlem, if you want to call where Columbia University is situated. They own half of Harlem. And I, like Byron and everyone else in the world, want to say happy birthday belatedly to Kay. I didn't realize that Kay shared the same birth date after all these years with the Reverend Al Sharpton, who had a function and symposium, a day-long symposium today. And I tell you, I was so emotionally moved. I have been off the air on a regular basis from BLS, LIB, Air America, 1010 Winds, and the like for almost 9 years now. And to just see people, and Kay, I had sent you an email. I guess it might have been difficult to attend. But the place, the graduate school at Columbia University, was the School of Journalism, was packed. Governor Patterson, Charlie Rangel, Mark Morial, Jesse Jackson, the leadership of the Essence magazine, Errol Lewis from New York One, and Amadou Diallo's mother, Iris Baez, Anthony Baez's mother, Sean Bell, whose father, all these people whose lost children who died because of police activity, and Corey Wise, one of the Central Park Five, who gave such a moving statement, as limited as, I'm not saying this with any kind of malice or bias, but, you know, having been imprisoned all that time, and for him to be out now, I guess the last 5 or 6 years, I forget, when they released him, but the anger and rage he has towards Donald Trump, who staged the campaign all those years for his false imprisonment, you know, I can't repeat what he had to say publicly about him today. And everybody was in tears.
With that full page ad that Trump did in the New York Times, you know, about Wilding, he alone indicted those boys at that time, and he was responsible for them being jailed. And
exactly.
No amount of money could replace that.
I tell you, Kate, I mean, you should have been there, because our history, and I don't like to blow my horn, and maybe this should not be the appropriate time to discuss this, but I really wish I could have sent for you, because you would have been really touched. I mean, after all these years, the years that you put in at LIB, the cases that we went through, and you tend to forget how many cases Al Sharpton has been responsible for. You know, I cried. I'm not ashamed. I'm 65 years old, Kay. He turned 63 on Monday, you know.
Wow.
I was just moved to tears, man.
Yeah, that's some drama.
I wish you were there.
Yeah, I wish I had known about it. I did know about it, but then, you know.
I understand it's difficult to, you know. Right.
Because it wasn't, you know, a major thing here in the Jersey paper, so I forgot about it. So, but anyway.
Yeah, that sounds like an exciting event. Both of those sound like really worthwhile events. It's ironic that, you know, one of the Central Park one of the Central Park Five was there, because that brings us obviously into the Trump. Our discussion for tonight is Trump versus the world, and Trump versus everybody. And he seems to have problems even with his own cabinet and people like that, Tillerson, the NFL, who else, Caulker, probably all of the Republicans that he's having trouble with. And the Republican Bob Caulker says that Trump is putting us in a potential World War III potential World War III footing. And so everybody, this guy has proven to be totally incompetent from a not only a current modern-day standpoint, but also a historical standpoint. And let me here.
Yeah.
There you go.
We are being joined by Dr. Leonard Jeffries. Dr. Jeffries, are you there? Dr. Jeffries? It's a 201 thing. Dr. Jeffries, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you
yes.
now. How are you? Yeah, how are you?
I'm fine. But you know, when it rains, you don't get the transportation you need.
Oh, boy.
We got caught in the rain, but, you know, we're all right. We're fine.
Yeah. We haven't heard from you in a while. You know, I know you've got a busy schedule there. And update it. I don't want to talk too much about Trump. I don't want to give him that power, you know. But tell people about your life up to this particular point. What are you working on? Been involved with the Black Power movement all these years. And you have quite a history, so to tell people what you were doing and about your course over there at what was it, CUNY or NYU or what? Talk to us.
Well, I did have a NYU experience, but that was only for a year. That was the year I went to law school. And but before that year, I won the Rotary International Fellowship when I was graduating Lafayette College in 1959, so it was a chance to go to Europe. So I went to Europe for a year, studied international affairs. My world got broadened. So law school was still there for me, but I went for the year and I realized there was a larger world out there and I need to be a part of it. So I completed the year in 61, then I went to Columbia in the fall of 61, got into African studies, got the first master's program out of their African studies program, and then I went on to do my master's on Senegal economic development plan in 63. I got a grant to continue on the PhD, and I did that work on the Ivory Coast economic development, and then I came back in 67. And we came right back into the Black Power movement, the urban explosions, and everything else. So I had to split myself. I had to be involved in international level with Africa and at the same time deal with the local level in terms of the urban rebellion, the Black Power movement, trying to help Black folks organize themselves. And so I've had a fantastic experience. That's been local, born and raised in Newark, New Jersey. So I was a part of the urban community and the village that produced us. The Roosevelt section of Newark was a virtual village. 14th Street is where my brother and I and my mother and father lived. 13th Street was where my mother's family lived. And on 12th Street, my father's family. So we had a virtual village of the 100 kids, youngsters I grew up with, 90 of us made it. And many of us made it big because there was this African village atmosphere that helped us through. And so we got a good education in the Newark schools. And that education served us well. I graduated as the president of the class at Sussex Avenue School, five or six of us Black youngsters, and they had five or six of us, and we got leadership training that was in the late 40s. Then in the 50s, we got involved with the NAACP. Grace Baxter Fenderson organized the Newark NAACP Youth Council. And in Orange Maplewood Branch, you had Madeline Williams, and she was giving special training to the Payne brothers, who you know, and to a whole host of us, others. So we had young leadership being trained in Newark and also in Orange Maplewood, in the Oranges and Montclair, to prepare us for the struggles that blew up in the 60s and continued into the 70s and 80s. So I consider myself a long-distance runner in terms of the struggle on both sides of the Atlantic. And so I've been blessed.
Yeah. And the struggle continues. Where are we? I mean, where are we? Both all of us can, you know, talk about this. Where are we now? What do we have to do now? What's happening now?
We're involved in what I refer to as Pan-Africanism and linking our global black communities together.
Jump in here, Wayne, Byron, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm listening. Good evening, Dr. Jeffries. Good to hear your voice as usual.
Well, it's good to be at this stage. It's good to be heard because I'm Al Sharpton's a youngster compared to me. And I celebrated my 80th birthday.
Well, your presence was, I tell you, your presence was needed today. We were just talking about the importance of organizing, and well, you're a youngster to the Congressman Rangel, who turned 87, I think, this year, you know, and you know, he's healthy. He looks healthy to me. I mean, he's walking with a cane now. I didn't really get a chance to talk to him, but you know, you were the front guard. I mean, you're part of that generation of leadership that showed that cleared the path for, you know, the young folks like Reverend Al and others. And one thing that I have to say, and again, you know, in a little bit, I say this with a certain amount of shame because I have not been as active since, you know, being off the air all these years, just trying to stay afloat with what I do. But the thing is that I'm admiring people like yourself who are reaching out to younger folk and at least letting them know, especially in these dire times in the era of President 45, how we need to revisit and reset the clock in terms of our activism to get somebody like him out of office as quickly as possible.
Anybody?
Any?
Yeah.
Definitely.
Professor Jeffries?
Yeah, this is Byron. Yes, I concur with you. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Jeffries.
No, I was just saying that Trump
You
I don't know if you heard all of what I had to say, but it's just that what's important now that, you know, we cannot afford to sit back and rest. And there's such a dichotomy between our generation, and I'm a couple of years younger than you are, just a couple, and the millennials who seem to have embraced the social media network. And it's a powerful tool, but they really don't know how to use it. I think to at least that was the opinion of many on the panel today in terms of fighting what's going on with this, and I hate to use cultural revolution, but this throwback to the 1950s and 40s with Trump's belligerent attitude trying to reinstate Jim Crow, you know, subtly, not so subtly.
The good thing about history is that it has a tendency to repeat itself.
Yeah.
And so we need to, I try to tell our folks, don't get too excited, don't get too nervous, don't get too upset, don't get mad, get glad, don't be sad, be prepared. And that's when the big attack came on me around the curriculum, and I went to 300 universities around the world. That was my theme. Stop worrying about the behind and get into your African mind. And so I'm saying the same thing with Trump. We're all excited about Trumpet. We create what I call a paralysis of analysis, focusing on the individual or the personality or the phenomena circumstance we need to focus on systems. We need a systems analysis. And a systems analysis will let us see the larger picture, will let us see not just the individual, but the individual's role in terms of systems. And every system has three major components: economics, which is your creative, productive capability, politics, which is your management capability, and culture, which is the values and whatnot. So we have to see the African people struggle over the last 500 years producing a global community that is going to try to organize its economics, politics, and its culture and try to fit in where they can. Fit in Brazil, half the black population, half the population there is black. Fit in the West Indies, where most of those islands are black because of enslavement. Fit in Black America, and then have a special relationship with the most important continent on the planet, and that's the continent of Africa, where the great wealth still lodges, where human populations were born, where culture and civilization reached its height. So even though we're on the periphery of the African world, we're key and crucial because we're in America, and it has become so powerful, not because America achieved greatness because of its own purity or its own idealism. America achieved greatness because they had free land. The Native Americans' lands were taken from them, and as a result, Native Americans went into a genocidal process, having been imposed upon them. And then free labor from the African populations by the millions brought over to work these lands, and then free resources out of these lands. So that's what made America great, not the idealism of freedom, justice, and equality, because there was no justice for people of color. There was no equality for people of color and even white folks. America was founded on rich white men with property and power, and Trump symbolizes the latest version of rich white men with property and power, just as Jefferson and Washington and others also represented that whole process. So we got to have a systems analysis. So when you put that in place, the Jeffersons and Washingtons and Madisons, with their contradiction of talking about freedom, justice, and equality while they were establishing the system based upon enslavement. And then after slavery was ended with our great efforts in the Civil War, then we thought we were going to get our freedom. We did not. We got the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, which supposedly freed us, which supposedly gave us citizenship rights, which supposedly gave us the vote. But in point of fact, after a short period of the Reconstruction was sold out to this new economics of capitalism, monopoly capitalism, symbolized by the Rockefellers, the J.P. Morgans, the Carnegies, and the rest. And they got control of the American government up to the 1900s when Teddy Roosevelt said, we need to break these trusts. And these powerful forces still control the government. They still create even a black man as president. And that, of course, was Obama. Black people didn't mobilize, organize, and put Obama in. The system had collapsed, and they needed to go to black to try to put the system back together again. Perfect person to do that was our brother, President Obama. So that we'll survive the Trumps, and we'll survive these other insanities, but we have to find unity, a global unity. Put aside the conflicts and the confusion. Put aside the fact that we have what Dr. Wade Nobles called a shattered consciousness and a fractured identity. Wherever we are, we're on a little island in the Caribbean, and we're saying we're Jamaicans. You're Africans who happen to have been worked to death on the island of Jamaica. Or we identify as South Carolinians and separate ourselves from the North Carolinians. When we are all an African family, once that consciousness is developed, we can move on our way of achieving what we need to achieve. And we're in the period of African Renaissance and rebirth. We're in the period of getting our consciousness back. That was the struggle that we waged in the 90s and 80s when we were talking about the curriculum of inclusion, not putting the worship of the great American white fathers, but put the truth of the world history in the curriculum so that people can grow and be a part of human development. So We have to look at the current situations, but don't get lost in the details. Don't get lost in the moment. See the sweep of history. And the sweep of history applying to black folks and people of color is, and then we rise. And Maya Angelou and others got it right. We are rising. But we have to see how difficult that situation is going to be, because if we don't put at the center of the rise struggle is the key. Struggle is the, as Frederick Douglass said, if there is no struggle, there's no progress. He knew it better than anybody else because he had been an enslaved person. So, you know, this is what we've been trying to bond together and teach and preach so that we can continue the what I call the rebirth, the renaissance of African folks.
Do you find that there is that excitement about black life and about the history of black Americans in this country with our students today, with our college students today? Or is it like blending things, not taking it seriously, that racism still exists in very strong pockets in this country? So how do we know what to do about it? How do we know what to teach the children about it, the students about it? Because there used to be a time, when we were on the air and we were the whole audience, when we had this huge audience. Remember Wayne and Al?
Yeah.
Byron? Remember those days?
Yes, I do. Dr. Jeffrey. Dr. Jeffries is absolutely correct, because one of the things that as a historian and like yourself, who have been a very good fan of yours for a long time, is to understand that if we don't know our history, it's almost impossible for us as a people to liberate ourselves. You can't just start from zero or nowhere. You have to start from a beginning and understand our origins to Africa, understand the cultural realities about our specific ancestry and what they were able to achieve. And if we don't teach that, it's impossible to understand who Fannie Lou Hamer is, who was Harriet Tubman, what did they do that succeeded so well? And we don't teach it. We just don't teach that in our schools. And so we end up with a generation who don't know how to overcome.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And I also have to say, and to piggyback on what Byron was just talking about, is that we as a people have a responsibility, if we're not getting it in the schools, to be at home instructing our children. And I think too much of the onus goes on the educational, in terms of those people who are involved in the educational environment in bringing everything to the fore. And very often, I had a conversation with someone yesterday about this very subject that, there's no inspiring, there's no inspiration or no effort or discipline coming out of the home to see to it that the children are really getting a grasp of what they're learning, what little they're learning, or what they are learning in school, and that's it. But something has to be done to improve the curriculum. That I know more is being done now than what it was 40 years ago when I was in school. But at the rate things are going now, we are bound to repeat the same mistakes over and over again because we don't know our history. We don't embrace, what we've accomplished, and stuff like that. And it's just so important, I don't like to single out one particular ethnic group, but, when I think of the Jews, they make sure that they never forget any one of their kids, they realize what struggles they've gone through. But we have such a strong, rich history, too, and not enough is done, in my opinion, my myopic opinion, to promote it in the classes. I know, Eric, your father was involved, very deeply involved in promoting the, my mind is mush now, but there was an agenda that he was putting forth in all the New Jersey schools to see to it that, a particular discipline was being taught, and I think it's commendable, but we need more efforts like that across the country. and that's the problem.
That was the Amistad Committee.
You're right. I'm sorry.
That's just,
you know.
But,
Dr. Jeffries. Yeah, Alzheimer's is sinking in. Rigor mortis is next.
But, you know, Dr. Jeffries and Wayne, one of the things that is encouraging is that this access to information technology, using social media to be instructive, not just gossip-filled, but use it to instruct, use it to teach, because right now its access point is to billions of people, and we don't have that access in our traditional formats, so we have to use what is available right now.
Amen.
And make sure that we filter in educational moments so that our people and the global community will recognize that cultural diversity is accessible to all.
Right. Amen. Amen for that.
Well, I certainly agree that we need to use these new techniques and modalities to put that truth in the world history in the hands of people. But unfortunately, there are folks who can't handle it. I mean, the big lie of white supremacy and white domination and white control is so real that when we talk about the human family emergence of Africa and the foundation of it, of civilization and culture coming out of Africa, and then other groups benefiting from the great African contribution in the Nile Valley and other river valleys, it's hard for people to accept. And so the fight continues even with this modern technology, because when you talk about science and culture and those important transformations of the mind, people don't run to them. They have to be led to them. When you talk about sex and love and entertainment and games, people go there automatically. And so even though the technology is there, I know for a fact that youngsters are accessing sexual information that they don't need at the ages that they're accessing it. And I know that our people, as great as we are, as wonderful as we are, still continue to step in doo-doo, to use an expression that I should not use. It's not very academic. But the latest film that our queens have produced, talking about the girls out, or whatever, the girls night out with Queen Latifah, with Will Smith's wife, Jada Pickett, for these achieving women, successful women, millionaire women, to feel that they can enhance their role as image makers by doing some mess like that, that's the difficulty. And I was glad Sister Soldier, she lives up the street from me, and when she's in the country, she goes to my mother's house, and she stops me in front of the house. We talked for an hour. She was upset. She said she sent a note to Jada Pinkett and said, why would you lower yourself at this stage of the game instead of producing the image of a queen mother or a queen or a leader of our community? You have to wrap it around sex and all of that mess? No. So in spite of the education that we have, the wealth that we have, there's a system that pulls us down to the lower levels of our being, and that's around the private parts, and it blocks us from going to the higher levels of our being, and that's the mind. And the mind is the key, and we have to Africanize our minds because it's been so warped and messed over, and people might want something different, but there's so many powerful forces that have prevented our truth from being realized, and our great struggle has been to restore and fight for African humanity. That's the great story that needs to be told. And so we've been trying to tell it. A lot of scholars around the world have been a part of it, and there's an awakening with the truth emerging. But it's not going to be easy. There's negative technology aspects as well as positive. I'm living down one now. 2017 is the 100th anniversary of the murder of my grandfather in Georgia.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
Fortunately, next year will be, and 2018 will be the 150th anniversary. And he was born in 1868. when we were supposed to
can
get the 14th Amendment.
Please?
Hello?
Dr. Jeff, yes. Can you repeat that,
yes.
please? What? Of your relative?
That,
your father?
My grandfather, my father's father. This is the 100th anniversary of his death, and we're celebrating it. Many of us never knew him. Even my father was the last of the 13 kids that he had with his wonderful wife. And my father, my father was born in 1914, so he really did not know his father. But these African peoples fighting out of slavery have left us a blueprint to follow. In other words, my grandfather was born in 1868 at the time of the birth of the first Ku Klux Klan. His brother Sam was born in 1865, just before the Klan was formed in 1866 in Tennessee. My grandmother, half white, and she had nothing to do with her father because of the circumstances around slavery and post-slavery. My grandmother was born in 1870. Now, that's interesting. 1865 is the end of slavery, the 13th Amendment. 1868 is the giving us citizenship rights, supposedly, the 14th Amendment. And 1870 is the vote that was supposed to be given to the newly freed Africans in America. And to be very frank, for 10 years or so, we had those rights. And we began to vote. We began to take land. We began to build institutions. And when white folks looked up after the Civil Rights Act of 1865 had been passed, giving us greater freedoms to function as in America, white folks got together with the election of 1877, the Hayes-Tilden presidential election. And they sat down, seeing and knowing what black folks was doing to pull people together, including poor whites, progressed with the programs that black folks talked about. For example, they wanted public schools. Education was the key. So black people, after the Civil War, fought for public schools. That meant it helped even poor white folks. But the rich white folks got together in a compromise in 1877. They called it the Great Compromise. And the compromise was, we're going to begin to roll back the success of these black folks. In 10 years, no people on the planet have done all that they did in taking land and working the land and building schools and building churches and setting up institutions like the Eastern Star and the Masons. What black folks did in the 10 years from 1865 to 1875 has to be studied by everybody. It was so powerful that when white folks got together, they said, we got to stop these black folks, because they're going to even wake up poor white folks, and then we're going to be in trouble with the wealth and whatnot that we control North and South in America. And so the compromise was that they would take out the black troops that were in the South, the 9th and 10th Cavalry particularly. They would take them out of the South to protect the newly freed Africans. They would send them west to chase down the Indians, and eventually they became called the Buffalo Soldiers. And while they took the military out of the South, the Ku Klux Klan rose to intimidate and to push back the gains that black people made. And so my grandfather was born at the birth of the first Klan. He survived that. And in the, down the South, when I went to see the school that they built, 125 years is still standing. The churches, you can see the four or five cornerstones of the churches that they were building from the time they got a chance to be free. But then in 1915, the new technology of the cinema had its impact. And this new technology of the cinema, just like the technology we have now around computers and whatnot, had its positive and negative. It was positive for white folks because D.W. Griffith, who was one of the key players, took the book called The Klansman and rolled it up into a fantastic epic movie film called The Birth of the Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the birth of the Ku Klux Klan.
The birth of
1915. The birth of the nation was the new technology that gave white folks a chance to show that black people could be intimidated by fear, that black men just wanted white women, that black legislators were watermelon eating black people with their feet up in the Congress or wherever they were in the legislatures of the South. It was the complete negative depiction of the gains that my grandfather and others had made. And so that technology, the birth of it, everybody profited from it. The president of the United States, the Trump of his time, was someone, Woodrow Wilson, president of Princeton, a Southerner, president of Princeton, because Princeton was a preserve for the elite of the South to educate their people on how to control the economics, particularly the economics of cotton. And so Woodrow Wilson had that monstrosity that was so dynamic. He had it played in the White House, and he described it as like writing history with lightning, with the big lie of white supremacy, with the inferiority of African peoples. And so that's why I say we got to have a system and understand that. It's amazing that my grandfather had 50 years to put his thing in place and then was destroyed by the Klan. Not because he was poor and stealing anything, not because he didn't have land. He had land. His brother had land. The sisters had land. His wife's people had land. They were setting up their own institutions. They didn't want to integrate with white folks. They had their black churches. They had their black fraternal orders. In fact, his statue, his grave, the monument over his graveyard when I discovered it in 1976, the monument over the graveyard is a Tekken. A Tekken is a symbol of resurrection and rebirth. The Washington Monument is a Tekken. So this person born 1 foot out of slavery was honored by his people with the tallest tombstone in the graveyard. And when I did get a chance to go there in 76, the twin pillars of masonry were on it, as well as his vital statistics. Jesse Jeffries, born in 1868, August the 10th, 10 years before Marcus Garvey, but in the week that Marcus Garvey was born. And he died July the 14th, 1917. So we need to know that history. And when I met my grandfather, who I never knew, and my father really never knew, when I met him in the graveyard as an ancestor, and when I realized what they had done, I've been fighting like hell ever since. I said, there's nobody going to turn me around. There's no movement. There's no money. I'm going to fight for that enormous truth. And that grandfather is in me. He's in my brother, my younger brother, who produced those brilliant youngsters that all of you know. One of them is Hakeem Jeffries, and his real name is Hakeem Sekou Jeffries. I gave him that Sekou to link him to African history and African struggle and African leaders, and I was referencing Sekou Touré. When his younger brother came 2 years later, Hassan Jeffries, I told my brother, Hassan Hakeem is good, but we got to put that African in there. So we named him Hassan Kwame, after Kwame Nkrumah. These youngsters were born with the Jeffries tradition. They were born with the tradition of black folks. They were born with the tradition of great African leaders, and they have not missed a day in paying us back royally. And their whole generation, Hassan is in Ohio State, linked with Michelle Alexander. They're in the same research institute. Michelle Alexander's sister is his office mate, and his office mate made sure that he got tenure. When they voted for tenure, with Hassan having been in the office with Michelle Alexander's younger sister, she was made sure that he got a 32-0 vote to be a part of Ohio State's history department and African studies department. And his great work, his PhD, was transformed into a great work, Bloody Lowndes, The Struggle for the Vote in Lowndes County. So he took the work of Kwame Ture, who was Stokely Carmichael at that time, and Rap Brown and all those who were down the South. He told their story in his PhD. Outstanding work. So, hey, we have to understand the seeds that have been planted that we have been nourishing on. We need to move away from the pity parties and this and that ain't going to happen. if we could be hundreds of years in slavery and then come out of it whole and lay the foundations for churches and fraternal orders and schools and colleges, then we need to understand we, right now we're the 100, we're the 1.7 trillion African in America, but got a Negro consciousness that has been programmed against himself. And that consciousness means that he is so busy meaning us Negroes, consuming every bit of garbage that this society produces. We don't save anything. We're in the point of view of nations on the world. We rank about 16th or 17th ahead of hundreds of nations on the world. The black community's actual productive capacity is great, but our planning to use that capacity is poor. And so if we begin to put our plans in place and think about our future, start saving money instead of just consuming every garbage that the white folks put out, we're there to be the first to get it. And so, hey, I see the changes taking place. I appreciate it. That's why I went into education. We dealt with tens of thousands of students. We transformed them. Coming over to be in New York to deal with the African burial ground in the 125th Street area. Yes. At the bus station, a young man stopped me. He said, Dr. Jeffrey. So I said, brother, how you doing? He said, you changed my life. That was 25, 30 years ago. And we're still moving with that knowledge that you transferred to us. So look, we got the negatives, we got the positive. When you weigh them, we're moving, we're rising. The African Renaissance is real.
Dr. Jeffries, where in Georgia was your grandfather born?
When you leave Atlanta and take I-20 going south toward Augusta, you turn off at Route 142 going toward Monticello. And that community there is such a phenomenon.
I know Monticello, Georgia. My family's in Fayetteville, Georgia, and when I worked with Hosea Williams and went to Monticello when he ran for U.S. Senate there, and so got a chance to really have communion with the people of Monticello. They opened their arms up. It's a warm community. I've been there. Yeah. I know exactly where you're talking about. So your roots are strong, my brother.
But you also know the Jeffries family. Any Jeffries that's in northern Jersey is tied in with us. We have an enormous clan. And then part of the Jeffries spinoff is the Maddox. So Elliot Maddox, for example, is a runner. Maddox. Elliot Maddox was a center fielder for the Yankees, center fielder for the Mets, and center fielder for the Texas Rangers. He comes directly out of Vauxhall. The family lived on Union Street in Vauxhall with his father, who was an athlete. So, but the Jeffries and the Maddox are one, but attached to them is the Bronners. B&B Hair, one of the biggest industries in the black community, one of the 100 top businesses in the black community. B&B stands 50 or 60. And not only have they maintained this year, they're celebrating the 70th anniversary of maintaining the hair business, but they spun it off into these fashion shows and these great activities in Atlanta. And then the family, that religious thing is always there. Bishop Dale Bronner spun off a church with the support of his family and his father, the patriarch, Nathaniel. And Bishop Dale, when I saw him last year in Atlanta and at the airport, Roz and I gave him a hug, and we looked up, picking up our luggage. Who was standing over us smiling was Bishop Dale. And I asked him, how is that 17,000-member church doing? He said, Dr. J, it is 23,000.
That's right.
And then he asked me about the Epic Center. Now, when I went down there for a party last year or so, his mother had talked about that Epic Center. Roz and I finally did get a chance to go see it. Across from the 23,000-member church is a cultural health center, performance arts production center called the Epic Center that they spent $33 million. That church, that one church, inspired by this young pastor, put up a center right near Seven Flags or Six Flags, whatever they call it, And I was just there last November being honored when they had the first Black Power Awards, and they had over 1,000, 1,500 people packed in the place. You couldn't get in. And the people were dressed in African dress like I've never seen. I was worried about problems with the generation of the hip-hop and all of that, the rappers. But no, they're all Africanized. And so I received an award. The new head of the UNIA, he received the award. They're going to do the same thing again in November. And it was at the Epic Center, which was what was designed to be. You could have produce your films. You could have your health. You could have your ceremonies. You could have your conferences there. So, wow. All of that comes out of that one part of Georgia near Monticello. Now, if you multiply that by hundreds of thousands and millions, you know the impact that Black folks have had on this damn nation. Yes, let's make America great, but not going back into when America had slavery and they slaughtered the Native Americans. That's what unfortunately made America great in terms of the devil. But America, in terms of its ideals, Black people have fought for those ideals, and that has been a great help to America. But at any rate, those are some of the little comments that I wanted to add to the, you know, to the program.
Glad you did, Dr. Jeffries. That's some history to be proud of. And I would imagine that there are also just as strong families and work with strong history. But thank you for
that's
sharing
what
that.
That's, yes.
Yeah.
That's the history that has been kept so much. That is not unusual. That's what they did. They took land. They built on the land. They raised their family. Yes. All right. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Jeffries. You're an inspiration.
All right, now.
Have a good night, Dr. Jeffries. Yeah.
Yes, good night.
Now, we just have had a wonderful history lesson. And
It's so deep. I wanted to ask, actually, you mentioned the Maddox family. I was just wondering if he was related to Attorney Alton Maddox, who's also
Maddox,
from Georgia.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. We're probably all related at one particular point.
Yeah, that's true.
But I mean, he's something wonderful. I mean, I know he was feeling probably a little out of it because he was breathing heavily, but, you know, he still has quite a history.
Active.
Sure,
yes,
he's very active. And but anyway, so I'm so glad that I, you know, was able to get him because he is busy, and so is his wife, who is also a historian. So I really appreciate the fact that he would, you know, took the time to come on. They're also good friends.
Right.
Great show. I love the history. I love the history, y'all.
Well, you would, I.
Oh my goodness! Yes, and he and I mean, I've been a fan of Dr. Jeffries for a long time, and remember him well because his attorney, Joe Fleming, is one of my dear friends, we miss Joe Fleming, and his wife Temple Jean and I went to Hampton, and so we've known each other for a long time and fully respect all the efforts, and Joe really loved Dr. Leonard Jeffries when they were going through all that stuff with Alton Maddox, and so it's an honor to be on the show with him this evening. Thank you.
All right. I didn't even know your sound, Byron, like Joe Fleming is no longer with us. This is what you're saying.
He passed away. Yeah, he passed away several years ago. He was Calvin Butts's personal attorney as well.
Yeah,
so,
I'm saddened to hear that. I mean, I was not aware. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Great man.
Yeah.
And
a lot of history there.
They honored, Congressman Rangel honored him with a proclamation from the U.S. Congress at his going home services at the Calvin Butts Church.
Abyssinia.
It was a beautiful ceremony and, you know, a well-respected person like Dr. Jeffries, someone who's committed to the freedom and struggle, the development and history and understanding all that's important and why we must keep our history alive and be teaching it every single day.
Oh, certainly.
Exactly.
As I said earlier at the outset of the program, I wish all of us could have been there for the symposium today just to make a contribution. I mean, we need to remind everyone, you know, we all play a pivotal role, no matter how big or how small, getting the word out to having ourselves organized again. That's it. In a way, Donald Trump's election did us all a favor.
Yeah.
We need to organize. Organize.
Absolutely. And that's why we have the Kay Thompson Live show. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, that's right. Right.
The virus, thank you, Wayne.
Thank you, Kay. Happy birthday again.
I was a little bit under the weather, but it was a great show. I want to say thanks, everybody, for listening to Kay Thompson Live show. Thank you to Brother Byron, Wayne Gilman, and we'll be talking to you guys again next week. Byron Saunders.
Yes,
all right, sir.
Peace
thank you very much. Take care, Mr. Wayne Gilman. You take care, sir.
All right, thank you.
All right, take care. Thank you, everybody, for listening to the Kay Thompson Live show. You listen to the show every Wednesday evening live, 8 to 9 p.m., or it's archived. You can listen to it anytime you want. Thanks for listening. Take care. Kay Thompson Live show.